Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين. اهدنا الصراط المستقيم. صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. آمين.
You're listening to American Muslim 360, the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice protected.
Community-wide Shura and AM 360 invite you to promote your organization or event on the number one Islamic radio station in the nation. Affordable rates allow you to promote your event to strengthen our national intelligentsia and network. Contact underwriting today at cwsconline@gmail.com. That's cwsconline@gmail.com. Or call 910-317-0297. 910-317-0297. Together, we can remake this world into a better place.
The views expressed by the host guests are their own and not necessarily the position of AM 360 or the parent corporation, the Community-Wide Shura Conference, CWSC Incorporated. AM 360 content is intended as a community service and is not designed to provide specific personal, medical, financial, or legal counsel or other professional advice, and no liability shall extend to the host or hostesses of AM 360 or CWSC. We encourage you to seek an advisor for your specific circumstance.
Assalamu alaikum. It is Monday morning, 6th of February. And we are live on the air with MAP 5, Muslim American Power 5. I am one of three hosts, Cheryl Sutter, and I'm here with my fellow host, Sister Amatala Elijah Zabri, and Brother Fleming Elamine. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Good to hear you fine people this morning, and I want to welcome you. We have a great show lined up this morning, but before we get started, I want to just touch bases, see how you're doing this fine morning, and just see what's happening in the world. We got some lows and some real lows. There was some devastating earthquakes that hit Turkey and Syria this morning, or actually over the weekend. Did you guys hear about it?
Yes, I did. And our prayers go out to the people of Turkey, and we pray Allah for minimizing, inshallah, the number of deaths, but we hope for the quick recovery and the health of the people of the country. And encourage people to send aid that's necessary.
Yeah, there's been like I think in both countries so far they've killed. It's been like over 2,300 people who've been killed already. 7.8 magnitude. across the Middle East already. And then there's a second one, like 7.5. So these, like, it's pretty bad. These are the worst Turkey has seen in decades. And so, yeah, we're sending prayers, and they're going to need a lot. There's like 8,000 injured. And so that's an area that has been rocked by devastation. I mean, besides this, I mean, they've been rocked by devastation over the last, you know, couple of decades. And that's like $1 billion in economic damage, you know, and it could be up to 10,000 fatalities there. So there's a lot.
Yes.
Pardon me?
For we know from Allah we come and so Allah is our return. So we encourage our listeners to support any of the efforts that are made to help the people who suffered this earthquake, God willing.
Yes. And we're thankful to Allah that the American government is already on the ground with boots to assist in that capacity. I was so sad, and I'm sure most of us were, to see that mosque implode like that behind the earthquake. And sadly, there was one blown up, you know, not far from there, where all the worshipers were having making the prayers, basically, you know, by extremists. So we pray to Allah that we can get some peace, some comfort, and some resolve to those issues. And let's keep our foot on the gas pedal to get them as much aid as we can, inshallah, as soon as possible. Inshallah.
That's true.
Absolutely.
That's true.
Inshallah.
Yes. The government, as well as we have to encourage individuals to support. You know, I know that some of the Islamic charitable groups are sending out messages, so we ask people to support that, and also the UN Refugee Fund, they send out solicitations for support. So we're just asking people to support wherever you can.
Yes. And there are a host of NGOs, U.S. non-government agencies, who are very much involved on the ground over there. In fact, they get most of the work done, the NGOs out of the U.N.
Yes.
So all the non-government agencies that are involved in that recovery, let's support them to the best of our abilities with our prayers and our finances, if we can, inshallah.
Yes, God willing.
Inshallah.
So what else do we want to talk about this news? There's a lot going on.
There's a lot. I just got a couple other, just the top stories that I saw this morning as I was browsing through. What do you think? So we got a couple things. So the U.S. Shot down that Chinese surveillance balloon on South Carolina. That's on your side of the country, brother Fleming. And then,
yes.
They shot it down.
Did you actually see it in the sky, Brother Fleming?
No, it was too far. I'm in the middle part of North Carolina. That was on the coast. It's actually closer to Wilmington, North Carolina, between Wilmington and Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. So some of the debris actually fell closer to Wilmington, and they covered an area that went all the way down to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. But as soon as it got into the ocean area, it was safe. They brought it down. And, you know, Maxwell Air Force Base in North Carolina is one of the premier ones. In fact, North Carolina has about 8 different Air Force. Fort Bragg is here. You have the Marine Base here. You have quite a few military units in the state of North Carolina. It's a major employer, actually, for the state. So I was not surprised at all that they timed it to hit that balloon as soon as it cleared the country to avoid any kind of debris falling on innocent citizens.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, that drama.
And then that's a lot of drama. There was another thing I wanted to talk about, because last week we talked about environmentalism, and we were talking about racism, environmental. I'm going to call it injustice. And then just this weekend, we got news that Brazil wants to abandon this huge 34,000 ton warship. But the way they want to abandon it, at sea, which would cause an environmental disaster. And no one's really talking about it. and it would be an environmental disaster because the aircraft carrier would be abandoned in Sao Paulo, which is near Rio de Janeiro, right? And it's their plan to sink it. Tremendous environmental disaster. So I'm keeping an eye on it. It's a 60-year-old vessel. They want to scrap it to a. It was in this Turkish shipyard in 2021. In 2022, it set off for Turkey from this naval base in Rio de Janeiro. But then Turkey rescinded its permission to enter its waters, so saying that Brazil had to prove that it was free of like asbestos and toxic minerals in the construction. So they turned the boat around. And, of course, they couldn't prove it. So now they want to abandon it at sea. And if you think in the United States they want to affect us, try again.
Are there any organizations speaking up about this issue?
Yes. That's how some of us found out. Right. That's how we found out.
What organization?
This problem has been plaguing. Well, it's a lot of marine conservationists in the Basel Action Network, which is a big NGO that works on toxic substances in environmental disasters in our waters. They are the ones who brought it to, international attention, right? And that ship has lots of hazardous and valuable materials, and it's going to be in international waters. So
how
it's something that everybody's paying attention to.
Our listeners, mm-hmm. Cheryl, how would they get information, ongoing information? Is there a particular place they should go online to follow up on this issue?
Well, I can tell you right now, the Time just wrote a story about it. Time.com is probably one of the best places right now anyway, because everybody's following up on it. That's just one. Nigeria has put thousands of wrecked cargo ships and commercial vehicles have been littered in the coast. Venice has done it. In the United States, the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, they've estimated from 2013 to 2016, 5,600 boats have been abandoned in just U.S. waters. So I would say to go to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration website, and look at the marine debris program, and you will see what has been happening in our U.S. waters. It will blow your mind. It will blow your mind what's happening in our waters.
Okay.
And with that, I want to turn to it's February. It's February. And with that,
it's February.
I want to talk about greater than 28. We know it's Black History Month and it's greater than 28, and we deserve more than 28 days. We know that. Black history is American history, is world history, but Brother Fleming, you have a long history of this. Talk to us. Give us a minute and tell us just that 1 minute, and then I want to talk to you, Mr. Masala, because you are kicking off today's show. So Brother Fleming, talk to us.
Thank you very much, Cheryl.
Greater than 28.
Yes, sir. It is amazing when I was just reflecting on it for just a second, because Dr. Carter G. Woodson, as many of you know, was given credit for starting off this serious study. Even today, what he started still exists in the study of African-American life and history. But when he first started off this effort, there was very little research done on our contributions to history, period. And he would refer to people like J.A. Rogers, some of you may be familiar with some of his work, some of his books, and other very esteemed scholars who were doing work, but getting very little credit for it. But it started just as a one-week celebration, and it was designed that way to celebrate two people. Frederick Douglass' birthday was occurred during that week, and Abraham Lincoln. So initially, that was the 1 week they called, quote, Negro History Week. And, of course, over time, it expanded into a month. And, of course, in some communities, we have it as a part of the curriculum. The students take this on a regular course basis, and they study it, of course, the entire year. But people like Dr. Carter G. Woodson, who wrote that seminal book entitled The Miseducation of the Negro, and others have written responses to that over the years, but that was sort of the beginning of it. And I had my students, when they were under my tutelage, to read most of J.A. Rogers' books, World's Great Men of Color, Nature Knows No Color Line. There's a whole series of those books that I would have to study, even in high school. And, of course, they would always say, oh, Mr. Alamein, the language. And I would say, get you a thesaurus. You'll understand the language and sweet by and by. But we need to celebrate our contributions. Very unique. If you just reflect on what your great-grandparents did in recent history, you can get a sense of what they had to go through to just make a living in this country. So we should never forget our origin, our uniqueness of the community, and we've had movements since Reconstruction to improve our life in this country. So let's celebrate, educate, and advocate for equality and equity in what we call the United States of America today.
Good. You gave
That's
us
what
a
I'm
good
talking about,
Brother Fleming. Yes. Carter G. Woodson was a really interesting person. A scholarly that he had that activist streak in him also. He wasn't just content to be in the academy. A couple of quotes from the book that you mentioned, Miseducation of the Negro, that I think can help to frame our conversation this morning with the great panelists that we have on. Carter G. Woodson is very inspirational, I would say, or should be, to modern-day scholars because he was able to take an idea that he had and put it into motion to have some social impact and social implications, which is going to frame part of our conversation this morning. Here's a couple of things that he said at the very beginning of the Miseducation of the Negro. The mere imparting of information is not education. Above all things, the effort must result in making a man think and do for himself. We can hear echoes of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's program in that quote, as far as do for himself. Another very important quote from the Miseducation of the Negro. The same educational process which inspires and stimulates the oppressor with the thought that he is everything and has accomplished everything worthwhile, depresses and crushes at the same time the spark of genius in the Negro by making him feel that his race does not amount to much and never will measure up to the standards of other people. I think that's important. He lays out for us the social impact of this kind of thinking that permeates in America today, vis-a-vis Governor Santos in Florida. We'll get to that a little bit later. But he also shows the crushing effect of it on the people, our people, who were once called Negro. We've been called Negro, we've been called colored people, we've been called black. The Honorable Imam Warasuddin Muhammad offered us the title of Bilalian to connect us back to ancestor Bilal ibn Rabah. We've been called many names, and through all of those transitions, what has been the impact of the educational system on the people, those who were in power with those educational systems, and those of us who suffered in those educational systems. But one framework that I would like to put forth to the audience and to our panelists is another quote from Carter G. Woodson from another one of his books called The Negro History. And in that book, he said, we should emphasize not Negro history, but the Negro in history. What we need is not a history of selected races or nations, but the history of the world, void of national bias, race, hate, and religious prejudice. There should be no indulgence in undue eulogy of the Negro. The case of the Negro is well taken care of when it is shown how he has influenced the development of civilization. So I think that's a beautiful framework for us in terms of looking at the founding, the history and evolution of Black studies and Africana studies here in the United States, but also throughout the world. As one of our panelists, Dr. James Garrett, who is one of the members of the student group that helped to found Black Studies at San Francisco State University, he has encountered traveling in the world, and I remember attending a presentation he made, and in Japan, I believe it was, there were students who were studying Black history or Africana studies and were just thrilled to talk with him to find out about how this movement began. So as Carter G. Woodson said, what has been or how the Negro, he was using the terminology at the time, has influenced the development of civilization. So for our discussion, our panelists this morning are Brother Umar Hakeem Day. Brother Umar Hakeem Day is a native of Compton, California. After serving 10-plus years as a director of the Intellect Love Mercy Foundation, ILM, is where he experienced grassroots accomplishments in community service. He now heads Encourage, I-N-K-E-R-I-G-I-J, I'm sorry, let me do that again, I-N-K-E-R-I-J, Encourage, is pronounced Encourage Foundation. Here he shifted his focus to lead what he coins as a breakthrough organization that focuses on community building, and he's going to tell us more about that. He combines both business and community service work into a social entrepreneurial model, helping the same service market build its power to combat social ills post-pandemic. He earned his business management degree and a master's in ethical leadership, but is all based on transferable skills and wisdom learned in Compton. Encourage is an advisory organization whose mission is to help to build capacity for purpose-driven organizations and individuals through program development, audience insights, and one-to-one leadership coaching. Our brother Umar will be with us during the first hour of our program. He'll be leaving the program, so we're going to have him to speak to us initially so that we can entertain any questions that come from the audience. Brother Umar, I know that two very important things that your organization Encourage has done. One, you've served as a consultant to the Muslim Public Affairs Council to include the concerns of the African-American community. I'll say three important initiatives you've been involved with. So if you've helped to set up, establish a consulting group there. You were also very active in the mayoral campaign of Karen Bass, who is now the mayor of L.A. And also you have developed and you are encouraging the imams, the leaders of the worship centers, the masjids throughout the country, to circulate a survey that you want to get the interest and the concerns of the members of our association. So I'll let you start with the survey first. Brother Umar.
Assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum as-salam.
Walaikum as-salam.
How's everybody doing?
Doing great. Doing great. Glad that you could join us.
Alhamdulillah.
MashaAllah, I'm so happy to be here. Congratulations on this effort. And we need more situations like this to guide, to tell our own story. So thank you, everybody, for having me here. As mentioned, my name is Umar Hakeem Day. I'm the founder of Encourage, which is an advisory that helps purpose-driven individuals and organizations. You said you want to start with the survey. Okay, let's see. The survey is a list of questions that's going to tap into the values and interests of the Muslim community. Now, this survey is not just the African-American community, but it is a broader, it's the broader Muslim American community here in the United States. As in Surah 21:19, Allah tells us that that he created one brotherhood. So the question is, a lot of us always say that we don't have one Ummah. We're not monolithic. Well, I believe we do have one community, but we have to start taking steps in that direction. And as a community organizer, the best way to start taking those steps is to listen to the community. And so in partnership with the Muslim Journal, in partnership with Muslim Public Affairs Council and several other organizations like CARE, Engage, and American Health, a lot of other organizations are involved, but we've got a survey. And this survey will take the interests and values to let us know who makes up our community, what makes up our community, what we are interested in, what do we have to offer, things of this nature. So in the community organizing realm, this is called a listening campaign. When you listen to the ground, because it's on the ground is where policies are birthed. You know, without the activists, without the social ills, you know, without the community leaders such as yourself, if we don't listen to one another, we're not going to know what direction to move in. So the end goal or the end game for this is to where are we going in 2024? So prior to that, we need some prerequisites into understanding who comprise of community.
Okay, so when you say 2024 and you say this is the end goal, is the end goal for what?
So, okay, check this out. So one of the questions on the survey is, does the Muslim community have power? And I'm not going to answer it. You know, maybe you three could maybe chime in on that, but that's one of the questions because we asked that question for the simple fact is in 2023, it's the beginning of the presidential election campaign. It's going to start probably around September or something like that. And you know that these candidates are going to be coming to our community asking for our opinion and can we endorse them, whether they're Republican or Democrat. In 2024, I would like for us to take more of a strategic position in who we align and who we align our voice with. So, you know, the end goal is to have an agenda that they could come meet. Let them talk to our agenda and say, this is what we believe in, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or maybe up to 10, I don't know. That's up to the people to decide, have an agenda and say, these are the values of the Muslim community, not just the African-American, but also the Southeast Asian, the Arab community, the Latino community, the Indonesian community. We want an agenda that represents ourselves, and this survey is that first step.
Okay. So now how I live in, let's say I live in Vallejo. How do I get this survey?
Okay. I do have a link. I guess I could post it into the chat, or you have it on record, but it's a simple Google form. I could provide the link. I could provide the link, and and just take the survey. It's an anonymous survey, so there's no saying, Sister Imadala, this is her situation. No, it's an open source survey, meaning that this data will be shared with all the community partners that's involved, and it's nothing too too private. It's really basic general, but it's some really engaging questions.
Okay, and so now you will, you're in the process of now of making people aware of the survey, circulating
mm-hmm.
the survey. When will
mm-hmm.
you start to analyze the survey?
I'm analyzing as we go, but I'm...
As you go,
we're analyzing as we go. And I hope to get at least 500 participants up to 1,000 or more to take this survey, because I want a real, I guess the word is composite of data to really come in.
Okay. All right. And so will you report back? So we'll have you back, let's say, God willing, if we still have the program in would it be
Yes. I'm more than open for y'all. I'm more than open for this situation.
Okay. So
I would definitely report
back,
but I also have in the mix though. I don't want to tell the bigger plan though right now, because I want to.
Sure.
I don't want to put the. There's a bigger vision to this that hopefully could happen
okay.
in at the end of 2023, but definitely. I'm going to be this is an open source situation where we're going to invite community members to key in, because we are outnumbered by other communities in a sense of voice. The Muslim community
okay.
has a strong voice, but we
okay.
really need to organize what we're doing.
All right. So now, talking about organize what we do, you were involved very actively, and we'll promote. You know, God willing, we'll promote the survey and encourage people to participate.
Thank you very much.
Let's transition to the work that you did and your involvement with the Karen Bass campaign in L.A., coming behind a very divisive situation in L.A. With the council members or supervisors, that whole debacle. What did you see
I know we before we do that, let's transition to one quick break. And let's take a quick station break.
Okay.
Hold that thought, brother. We're gonna take a quick
Yes, ma'am.
Get up and
okay,
shake.
We can do that.
Get up and shake your legs. Get up and shake your legs. Stretch your back.
I just did.
Give us one second. Give us one second.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Nirmat Shaheed, restorative justice practitioner for the Oakland Unified School District and host on AM 360's The Pearls of Women Quranic Mondays. We're asking you to help us make a difference in the life of a student. We need you to spread the word that CWSC is offering 5 college scholarships in the form of direct financial aid to students who qualify and are graduating from high school this year, or current college students. Learn more and apply online today at cwsc.us. But hurry, the deadline for applications is June the 20th. Thank you for helping secure our next generation's intelligentsia. Assalamu alaikum.
Because there is no God but the one God.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Edward Willis, advisor at Graceline Community, asking you to join me in supporting community-wide Shura Conference and American Muslim 360. Make your tax-deductible contribution today at cwsc.us or phone in your pledge to 910-317-0297. Again, make your tax-deductible contribution today at cwsc.us or by phone at 910-317-0297. Together, we can remake the world. Thank you.
And talking about remaking the world, talk to us. Let's get back to Ms. Karen Bass. You're up.
Hello, Ma.
You're back on.
That campaign.
Okay.
You mentioned that there are other communities that have a voice. Muslim community has a voice also that may not be always heard. What was your experience in the Karen Bass campaign addressing the situation there in L.A. and trying to go forward?
First of all, thank you, Sister Madalal, for bringing attention to this situation. First, here in Los Angeles, I'm also the board president for L.A. Voice. L.A. Voice is a community organizer in the PICO California network. And we have a C4, a C4, 501C4, where we could endorse candidates and bring them to the platform, because as a C3, you cannot endorse one candidate. You have to entertain both of them. So, and then, you know, C3s, we don't do endorsements at all. So under our C4, we was able to advocate and plan and campaign and endorse Sister Karen Bass to become mayor of Los Angeles. And it didn't just stop there. You have a brother by the name of Khalid Shaw, which is Naeem Shaw Sr.'s brother, Stop the Violence, Increase the Peace Foundation. We also participated in the campaign for Karen Bass at several churches around Los Angeles. So the idea was to find, to support a candidate that has Angelino's interests in front. And Karen Bass suit that bill. She's from Los Angeles. She started an organization called COCO, Community Organizing Coalition, and it is still thriving today as she went on to into the world of government. So the idea was to find or to support her and to support her in this endeavor of creating a better Los Angeles, because as you know, she has inherited a crisis. And when I say about that, anybody who comes into office inherits a crisis of the previous administration. And not that the previous administration didn't do the job, but it's just that she inherited a crisis. So in her first 100 days, she has declared Los Angeles as a state of emergency when it comes to homelessness. And she's working on a vision of bringing community partners in to tackle this situation. One of the things that I help organize with the Skid Row Brigade is the fentanyl campaign. There's a fentanyl crisis on the streets of downtown Los Angeles. And through the mayor's fund, we were able to do a campaign about the use of fentanyl and the overdosing and giving aid to those who are in the midst of an overdose. So the Skid Row Brigade is a crew that I consult on Skid Row, and we was able to do a campaign due to the mayor's fund. And so
can I just ask you one question? When you say the Skid Row Brigade, this was had the people on Skid Row organize themselves, or is this a separate organization? So they organized themselves. And so you were able to come in to work with them?
So the Skid Row Brigade is an organization, a group of activists on Skid Row that I've been working with for years. And
okay.
We've done a lot of grassroots works, and this is through the mayor's fund. And we was empowered to do a fentanyl campaign.
Good. Okay. And is this campaign ongoing, or can other people participate, help you in this campaign?
I have materials for it. I do have materials for it. I have flyers for it, because fentanyl is not only a Los Angeles problem, but it's across the nation, you know. It's across the nation. It's unfortunate that we couldn't get this same attention during the crack epidemic. But to get help to the people who are suffering from this drug is very necessary. So, but I want to going back to Karen Bass. I feel that she is the right person. The people have chose her to support Los Angeles and get it into the black of things. And you know, I have to be patient, because like I said, she inherited a crisis, but she does have a vision for Los Angeles. And I'm just going to be patient to see her plan unfold. And to be honest, you know, this is a full-time, round-the-clock job that she's going to be doing. So with LA Voice and the other community partners who was campaigning for her, we feel that she was the best person for the job of being mayor of Los Angeles.
Okay. Sounds good. Okay, so you had the survey. You talked about the campaign with S. Any other projects or activities that you want our audience to be aware of?
Yes.
Okay.
Where can I start, since I'm on the radio right now? I'm more of a fan than a panelist, you know what I'm saying? I'm excited. But I want the community that is listening, this show is a call to action, and we're giving you the task to get with the community organizers in your area and to listen to them, invite them in, and let's start building power for our communities. Because when the Muslim community build power, it not only build power for itself, but it build power for everyone who stay around our places of worship, our homes, anybody that needs help. We help the masses. But it's important to have a policy that's going to represent us, that we could present going forward. So, you know, this is a call to action. This whole radio show is a call to action to get involved. And because I think it was Malcolm. Was it Malcolm? Y'all can help me with this. He said, if you're not at the table, then you're on the menu.
Exactly.
So we no longer want to be on someone's menu. We want to have a seat at the table and organize our community, because, you know, if we don't get it right now, it's going to be another 20, 15 years before anything comes along that we could take a hold of. This is our time now, you know, and we can't trip on who's leading the work. You know, let's be collaborative in these efforts and in this situation. So let's not trip off of who's the leader, or that organization don't represent me, or I'm not down with that, or whatever. Let's get over that and stick to the law subhanahu wa ta'ala say in the Quran, to establish weight with justice and fall not short in the balance.
Okay. I realize that you have to go, but I do want you to hear from our next panelist, Dr. James Garrett, who shares that active background with you.
I can hang on for a couple. Hang on for a little bit more.
Okay.
So, can I ask him a question before he takes off?
Go ahead.
I had two quick questions for him. First, just to thank him for his work with the homeless population.
We have a group here called the Bethesda Homeless Center that I'm on the board with, and our mission is simply this, taking the homeless into homes. That's a massive undertaking, and there's a variety of ways you can do that. We've had to deal with mental health issues related to homelessness.
Yes.
And every year we do a count of how many people are homeless in Forsyth County, and the United Way has a program specifically in place for that purpose, and it's aligned with our mission. That is, from homelessness to home ownership. Another time we can talk more about that. But I want to also bring to your attention one other survey. The American Coalition for Good Government has also started a survey for 2023 inside a political interest and engagement survey, and it's already been issued out to some members of the community. And inshallah, you and I can work together to get the best effort out of these surveys. Ours is primarily focused on our community, and it's based on our platform that you can find on our website. But inshallah, we'll get a chance to talk more freely about that going forward. But the Muslim Journal, State Ellis Farm, and other entities have copies of the survey with our emblem on it.
Yes.
I don't want the people to be confused when they see that because this is just a 15-question survey getting specific data. We did it before when President Obama was in office, and we collected about 1,500 respondents. So we're trying to get at least 1,200 this time, inshallah. But I may send you a copy of that, so maybe you can glean something from that, and please share yours with me so we can work together, inshallah, going forward.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Sounds good.
Also,
elaborate.
Before I still got some, I can hang out a little bit more, but I also want to give a shout out to Muweed Incorporation in Oakland and the Eating Rights Project. They do a lot of good community service when it comes to serving the people. So it wouldn't be right if I didn't mention that plug right there.
Okay.
Oh,
well, let's do that.
I got one more plug.
We have the best sister, Amila. Okay, go ahead and plug.
Can I do one more plug?
One more plug.
If I have to pay for this, and if I have to pay for this, Erica, this part, just let me know.
No, you're good. You're good.
We have a... I'm going to tell a story. When I became Muslim in 1998, my foster mom wondered why I became Muslim. And when she got to thinking, her husband, Lacey, used to read me at that time was the Muhammad speech. And so she said that he used to sit me down out of all the children in the house. He used to sit me down and read this publication to me. So with that being said, we have the Muslim Journal. Please subscribe to this. Sister Aisha is doing a mashallah, a great job. We have to support this publication because you never know who it may spark to get into this game. You know what I'm saying? So I want to credit the Muslim community in the 70s and in the 80s for soldiering forward. And I believe we still have that same valor today. So please subscribe to the Muslim Journey.
That was a good plug. That's a worthy plug.
That was a good plug. Sister Matla, I do have a question. I have this question, and you can answer it now, or you can ruminate on it. And it is you made a statement about, and I appreciate the survey. We have lots of surveys about the Black agenda in different communities. So I would encourage you. Maybe you call it the Muslim agenda. Your survey, but you mentioned power, and so I'm interested in knowing what your definition of power is, because you said it quite a few times about that we need to own our power, we need to exercise our power. So I'm interested in hearing what you believe that to be for the listening audience. Thank you.
So for the listening audience, we all know about power. We know that there's no might and power except with Allah. La hala bala ila kuwata bala. I get my Arabic confused sometimes. La hala wala kuwata ila bala. We know that there's no might and power except with Allah. But personally, the way I define power is the ability to act or respond. So we have to harness our willing ability into a channel, into a container, so we can respond and act in a way that is appropriate to save our communities or to build our communities.
Okay. That sounds good.
Yeah.
So
that's my definition, because as a community organizer, my job is to agitate and or inspire. I hope whatever I said agitated you. You know what I'm saying? Could that get us into motion? But also I hope it inspires the listeners to also get into action.
Okay.
There we go.
That sounds good. Let's go to another agitator or a good trouble person, I guess, Late John Lewis would say. Dr. James Garrett. He holds a doctorate from Harvard University in political philosophy and also a doctorate in sociology of education. He received his JD right here in the Bay Area from Golden Gate University School of Law, and he is a member of the California State Legal Bar and the International Court of Jurists at The Hague. In the 60s, he worked as field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Committee, registering people to vote in Mississippi. As a result of his work, he was jailed and beaten by the Klan. James Forman, then executive secretary for SNCC, recruited him to lead an effort in Los Angeles, your hometown, Brother Umar, to recruit students and raise money for voter registration for SNCC. In the spring of 1966, he enrolled in San Francisco State University. It was there that he, Marion Al-Wadi, she's a sister who still resides in San Francisco and recently got out of the hospital, and our prayers are for Sister Marion's recovery. She was at that time leader of the Negro Students Association. Jerry Vanarda of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity, Joanne Mitchell, and George Murray, future leaders of the Black Panther Party, organized the first black student union in the United States. The BSU demands included increased recruitment of black students, the hiring of black faculty, support for student involvement in community projects, and a black curriculum. As convincing as he is, he was able to convince Sonia Sanchez and the late Amiri Baraka to serve as writers in residence at San Francisco State University. We know that at that time, Sonia Sanchez and Amiri Baraka, they were very important voices in the African-American community. The BSU and SFSU formed the Model for Future Black Student Organizations as they spread across the United States. In 66, he wrote a concept paper, Proposal for a Black Studies and Community Work Program. In 67, the paper was adapted by SFSU administration to implement the first Black Studies Department on a four-year college campus. Nathan Hare was hired to develop and chair the department, and these events sparked the longest student-led strike in USA history. Dr. Garrett's essay, Black Power and Black Education, published in 68, emerged as a pivotal assessment of black studies, of the black studies movement in the USA. He is also co-founder and director of the Center for Black Education in Washington, D.C., participated in the establishment of Drum and Spear Bookstore, which was the first Afrocentric bookstore in the Washington, D.C. area. He traveled the globe with Dr. C.L.R. James, the great radical intellectual activist to assist with organizing the 6th Pan-African Congress held in Tanzania in 1974. Fast forward to 2001, he served as staff delegate for the World Conference Against Racism held in Durban, South Africa. He also served as a delegate and sponsored students from California to the 14th UN Commission on Sustainable Development held in May 2006. Currently, he is president of Global Community Advancement Centers, which are 501c3, based in California. It focuses on educating stakeholder communities in the USA and internationally on the use of cooperative solutions and sustainable technologies, solar, wind, energy, et cetera, in human and infrastructure development projects. I could go on and on and on. This is just a brief bio, but Dr. James, and in parentheses, he'll always have Jimmy Garrett, is joining us. Dr. Garrett, so good to have you with us. How are you this morning?
Good morning, and thank you, Amatullah, particularly. But I think that I should thank the entire organization. I agree with the brother earlier who said that we should keep these doors open and in terms of communication, because you never know who it would spark. So I'll be listening to this program from now on.
Oh, well, thank you. That means a lot. That means a lot. And I'm sure that we'll call on you in the future, because the objective of the program is really to, we say, to encourage people to change faith into action. And when we say faith, we're not talking about you have to be of a political, religious persuasion. But as human beings, we have faith. It's in us. You have faith that you're going to see tomorrow, that you're going to be able to do whatever it is that you have in your mind to do. So we want people to take those good thoughts and those good deeds, those good thoughts and inspirations, and transform them into action, like Brother Umar and yourself have done in terms of with the community. When we initially talked, I wanted to, and your bio gives us some sense of the history of the founding of Black Studies / Africana Studies. Can you, I've heard, and I want to know if you agree with this, I've heard some people say that Black Studies started with looking at us from slavery, and Africana Studies looks at us from the very beginning. Is this a good definition or a framework that you agree with?
My short answer is no.
Okay.
So that's my short answer. There's some historic issues around that, of Black Studies, Africana Studies, Pan-African Studies. I remember either you or one of the members of your panels stated that we've been given a lot of names, and so that's just another example of history of people who don't have major control over their history, is that we end up using names and rituals as a substitute for control. So no, that's not. I've heard lots of stuff, but that's not the foundation for Black Studies. Doesn't begin there, and I do know that one of the first Africana Studies programs that was up at Cornell, the reason that it was named that was for a particular political purpose at that time. That's back, I think, in 1969. But it didn't have anything to do with one being having a longer historical reign. I mean, Africana, you know, is Roman, you know, so... Our history doesn't begin with Rome either. So, I mean, don't stop me on linguistics, so I'm going to leave it alone, but I'll just say that that's not true.
How they say, make it plain, brother, make it plain. Since you were there from the beginning, as a student organizer back there in the 60s, what was your vision for this Black Studies program? I mean, your department. What had you hoped that you were committed to?
Let me say that very quickly that I attended San Francisco State, then called college, after having been in the movement since I was 16. And that to me from 1960. And I had been fortunate enough to have been exposed to a number of different venues where struggle was taking place. I had been involved with the sit-in movements and the freedom rides. I had traveled to Africa with the American Friends Service Committee in 1962 to the places that were then that are now Burundi and Rwanda. So I had a history. I was very fortunate to have been allowed to be exposed, and I was kind of a sponge. But the purpose of going to San Francisco State in the winter of 1965 and then attending in the spring of 1966 was not to develop a Black Studies program or an Africana, Pan-African Studies, any studies program. The purpose was to see if it was possible to build a model for a Black movement on college campuses where the predominant attendance on the campus was white. I had seen how much of a good deal of the organizers that I was associated with in the movement in the South, in Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Georgia, et cetera, were people who were either high school students or they had attended historically Black colleges and universities. And what I'd seen over the from that period on was the increasing number of Black students, of Black people, who were matriculating in the North and West and East to predominantly white college campuses, because there were very few historically Black colleges in those areas. And they were those institutions were opening up to include Black students, Black GIs, people who were going on the GI Bill, young people from lower middle class and middle class communities, people from working class. People were going to schools. Wayne State University, for example, in Detroit had tripled its size. And 40% of the student body in 1966 was Black. So I was trying to see whether it was possible to build an organization on a campus that inclusive organization, included anybody who defined themselves as being Black, and use that institution as a base to train and prepare young people, young Blacks, to spend the rest of their lives in service to their communities. So that was the intention of going to San Francisco State. The intention was not to establish, build, or set up a Black studies program of any sort. And I'll finish with this: the Black studies evolved out of the struggle itself. It was a dialectical process, the coming together of a number of already existing social forces in the Bay Area, and trying to find ways to solve problems, to problem solve. That was how Black Studies, from my perspective, came about. It wasn't the original intention from my perspective was not to develop a Black Studies program as some kind of end, but Black Studies became a tool, an instrument in the training process that we were trying to build on that college campus and in the surrounding community.
And so your other committee members, Mariam and Jerry and Joanne and George, they also shared this kind of vision?
Well, when I came to the campus, that's an excellent question. When I came to the campus, there were a number of visionaries during that time. I mean, a lot of us, there were people like Edward X, who was with the Nation of Islam, who was on the campus mm-hmm. always talking about we need to change our names. We need to envision ourselves as being greater and bigger than what we are. There were a number of people already on that campus when I arrived. Who had visions. There was a cluster of people who defined themselves as Black nationalists One of the LaBrie brothers, Kareem's brothers, they were teaching a class on what was then called Experimental College on Black nationalism. So there were a lot of people. Maryam al-Wadi, who was then Maryam al-Wadi, was the head of the Negro Students Association, and her real focus was on providing a space for current issues to be discussed and to consolidate whatever kind of interest that the 130, 140 black students on the campus had. So there were a lot of people who had these kinds of visions. I was in training as an organizer. So my job is doing the best I could to pull together a number of different clusters and factions and cliques of people who had what they had in common was that they were black, but they were disparate in their interests, fraternities and sororities, church groups, black consciousness organizations, things involving dance, cultural dance, African dance, all kinds of things going on. So I've been in training, luckily, for a number of years, and I was trying to see if it was possible. What would it take to pull all these disparate groupings who had the commonality being black together and then take over this college? The idea was to take over the college. And that's one thing that everybody agreed with. They might not have agreed with each other on a number of specific things, but the whole idea that, I mean, the brazenness of a group of black people not talking about integrating into a particular grouping of whites or whoever, but boldly talking about or discussing, why don't we just take this thing over and control it and use it for our interests? How weird was that? So that's what people bought. That's what people bought. Oh. I couldn't sell them anything else. I wasn't trying to sell them anything else. But they saw that commonality, and because of the historical context, they came together.
Okay. Hold that thought. We're going to continue the discussion. I think maybe we should break at this point for another public service announcement, Sister Cheryl, and then we'll get back.
Yes, ma'am.
You or Brother Fleming have a question for Dr. Garrett. We'll go into that.
Thank you, ma'am. Hold tight. Take a stretch. Shake your feet.
God's peace be upon you. God's love be upon you. God's compassion be upon you, the one soul of humanity. May we let it be in thought and in action. On behalf of CWSC Intelligentsia, the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice protected, American Muslim 360, the Speakers Bureau, the Model Community National Resource Directory, the Volunteer Human Resource Network, Scholarship, the Learning Lab, Ambassadors, National Leadership Advisory Council, Internship, Leadership Development Council, the Think Tank, Strategic Family Institute, the bookstore. May we share completely humanity in spirit and in form, from thought to action. God's peace, God's love, God's compassion. Assalamu alaikum.
So,
and we're back.
Brother Fleming, do you have any questions for Dr. Garrett?
Yes. First of all, I want to thank him for his presentation so far and congratulate him on his sacrifice, because I know it's not easy. A 30-second comment, then I'll ask a question. You know, I was at Cornell College in Mount Vernon, Iowa, from 1970 to 1974, and when I got there, the students had taken over the administration building the year before in 69. There were only 17 African-American students on the campus. Let me say that again. There were only 17 African-American students on the whole campus. Now, this is a one red light town in Mount Vernon, Iowa, surrounded by cornfields. So when I got there, you know, because of the guy who brought me to Cornell College, I wanted to go to Morehouse. I became the new African-American president, you know, of the society, et cetera. But we had the same strategy. What can we do to agitate this place and make sure we're in control on some elements? So we came up with a little plan that every student had to first graduate. So we had a program at our African American Society building that you had to come to us to do your 101 English, do your calculus. We had people set up who knew those areas pretty well. So that was our first program. The second was, what are you going to do in this magazine to commit to serving your community after you graduate? Same kind of process, same kind of thinking. But that was very commonplace during the late 60s and early 70s. My question is, what has happened to all that energy? What has survived that effort, in your opinion, sir?
Well, first, I have no doubt that that the cornfields in Ohio, or Cornell, you were taking some chances out there. In where? In Iowa?
In Iowa.
Iowa.
I'm running Iowa.
Oh, good.
The most.
Good gracious.
Yes.
There was a national consciousness that had grown over a period of maybe 15 or 20 years that culminated in that level. I mean, if you have your public distillers of culture, their war, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. That's Barry Sloan. Or James Brown's I'm Black and I'm Proud. That consciousness had become common, and there was a transactional relationship between the public or larger culture within the Black community and people who were activists. We worked, joined with each other in many cases. So I think that development over time it didn't start at San Francisco State. That's what I was trying to, and maybe not a very articulate way, try to express. There's already movement activity in the minds and hearts and sometimes in the physical action of Black people. I mean, I had gone to Parchment Prison. I spent time in prison trying to organize Black people around the simple notion of voter education and registering to vote. So that was a growth of motion and activity over 15 to 20 years that got me to the point I was, and a lot of other people, including a number of the people who are our listeners. So I don't see what I was doing as being special. As Amilcar Cabral said, I was a simple African man doing my duty in my own country, in the context of our time. Now, in terms of the present situation, I think these things are much more complex. I mean, instead of having a lack of information, we in some cases have an overflow of bad information. And so people live or wake up in the morning and go to sleep at night holding their cell phones that might dispense 1% positive and then 99% negative communications flow. It's more difficult. But still out of that, we did have, Movement for Black Lives. Hundreds of thousands of young people. We had a number of movements in Florida of young people who built organizations and movement, apparently elected a couple of people, young people, to Congress this past election, as Brother was talking about, sister that I've known a long time, Sister Bass, because I don't know if the brother knows this, but I went to Jefferson High School and George Washington Carver, a junior high school. I grew up in Los Angeles. But I think that now what we have is both pressure to produce, and we have some outlets like the one we're using right now. Young people are using a technology that I still don't have a handle on to communicate with each other despite all these problems and issues, all the dynamics. The other thing is that many of us were either local, almost villains, almost local to our communities, like Compton and South Los Angeles or Watts or or Hunters Point or West Oakland or Harlem or wherever. But over this time, we are now international or global. Wherever I go in the world, and that's a lot of places, I run into people from the African diaspora, from the African continent, who are working together in terms of world development. So I think that we've expanded our visions in some ways, and we are combating as best we can with the impositions that are much more complicated to deal with, from my perspective, than they were 50, 60 years ago. But I think we do the best we can with the tools that we have. I'm very positive about young black people. We might be a little bit far. We haven't discussed the development of black studies yet, but I'm very positive and optimistic about the young people who I come in contact with, young black people particularly, but not only those, because I conduct classes with students in Dubai, Myanmar, Japan, Guyana, Namibia. So I'm very fortunate in that sense. But I'm very positive about young people, about the questions they ask, and about the attempts and directions that they've taken.
That's inspiring.
Yep.
That's good. Sister Cheryl, did you have a question? I'm nervous when she takes a deep breath like that. What is this question going to be? Go right ahead.
I always take a deep breath. I think it's fabulous. I'm a little further behind in the discussion in terms of timing. And by the time I came along in high school and college, you know, these programs were already preset. They were actually a requirement in Spelman and in my high school. And I grew up in the Midwest in, I call it Wonder Bread country. So we were reading black history and even in the white suburbs of Missouri. So I always find it interesting, and I'd like your take on somebody who grew up in this suburb, the North St. Louis County suburbs, why we were more apt to have black history lessons in our classes, where when I came out to California, my husband grew up in Berkeley, and we had more history than they did in Berkeley, which I found altogether puzzling and a little disturbing. They did not teach these in their classes.
I don't know when that was, but I do know. I mean, I don't know.
He was in the 80s. He was in the 80s. I was later behind him.
Okay, my one of my daughters is the director of the Oregon Shakespeare Fest Festival. Her name is Nataki Garrett. She attended Berkeley High School. That was a big struggle in Berkeley, even in the 80s, when she was in school. That was because in the 70s, there was such a drive to expand black education, or the education about the history and so-called contributions of black people around the world. But one of the problems was that we were still training people to develop that kind of consciousness. And the Deep South, one thing that was allowed, because people did not think that you were going to use it for any. I mean, I was born in Dallas, Texas, one of the most apartheid-based cities in the United States. And we had at least the Booker T. Washington kind of black history. A lot of times where there's a predominance of whites who are in the public school system,
they're not prepared or trained, and nor should they be teaching black studies if they're not prepared or trained, don't have the proper perspective to build things out. I do know that in a lot of the schools around the country, I mean, I work to build black student unions in high schools and colleges across this country. I mean, at one point there were 1,200 black student unions in high schools and colleges around this country between the late 60s and the early 80s. So there was a lot of work done to put those things together, and that's why I thought that it might be useful to put some of that in historical, to go ahead and talk about how black studies and community work programs expanded across the country, because that was struggle. That was intense struggle that went on. People lost their lives, they lost limbs, they went to prison, trying to bring that about. And, you know, there are going to be highs and lows, and they're going to be places where they develop in a very strong way, because there might be individuals who might be available to bring that out, and there are places where they're going to develop weakly. My daughter had a very strong had very strong teachers at Berkeley High who were mainly black teachers. Of course, she was shocked to find out her father had been active, because for her, her father was just her daddy. And so she lived a life, but she lived a life as normal, not as something extraordinary. So she was shocked that people saw some kind of heroics when she just saw the guy who made oatmeal in the morning.
Okay, so you've mentioned as far as talking about that struggle of the development. Is there anything else you want to share about that? Because you wrote this proposal for Black Studies and Community Work Program. Is that what you're referencing?
Yeah, no, what I'm saying is that there was a two-year program called the Black Curriculum that was instituted at the Peralta Colleges in the fall of 1966. And that was we used that as part of our own work. But what we were trying to do, we had built in very short order, powerful movement on San Francisco State College's campus. I mean, we did literally, we took over the student government. We had strong influence on the president of the university. We had expanded out into the community. The whole thing was to train people to go into the community. So we had over 100 black students in tutorial programs, community involvement programs, and various cultural programs. We had brought Amiri Baraka and Sonia Sanchez. Actually, it was Sonia Sanchez who worked with us to commit Baraka to come out. The Black Communications Project. So we had people involved in filmmaking and all kinds of things. And then what we were trying to do was to act as a funnel. We wanted to funnel people into the community, so that into the various communities. But in order to do that, we had to develop the consciousness, the framework. We didn't want to send people, black students, out with a white consciousness. So we started political education sessions and various classes. School allowed us to teach classes and give students credits, but we found we needed to consolidate that. The Black Study and Community Work Program was a natural development that emerged from that work. At the same time, we were forcing the schools, the institution, to open up to bring more and more black students on campus. When I got to the campus, there were 130 black students and probably another 50 non-white students on the campus. When I left that campus on my way to prison in 1968, there were 1,200 black and students and people of color. So we had increased our numbers by a factor of 10. And all of those people had to go through an educational process. And that educational process emerged or developed as the Black Study and Community Work program that the Academic Senate, the Faculty Senate at San Francisco State adopted in the spring of 1967. Then our job was to not only consolidate that, that's where Nathan Hare comes in. Nathan Hare, because he was a man of consciousness, he was a race man, and he had a PhD, so we brought him in. But we wanted to spread that out all over, use that model out all over the country. And we used the aegis of the Black Panther Party and SNCC and Kwame Ture and H.R.A.P. Brown and anybody else that we could use to spread that idea of Black student unions, community work, and the development of Black studies programs. So it wasn't just us doing it. Now, the cost of that was that, as Brother pointed out, 17 students took over the administration building at the college that he was attending in Iowa. A group of students at was then called San Fernando Valley State College did the same thing. About 30 students corralled, took over an administration building. Six of them were convicted of kidnapping and were sentenced to 10 years in prison. By the time I left San Francisco State in 1968, I was given a five-year case for assault on the police officer with a deadly weapon, although I was almost beaten to death during that fracas. There were people who paid great price for that. There were families that were destroyed by that movement. But that's what happens in these kinds of struggles. But the end product was to spread that first generation called Black Studies and community work. Our thing was that there could be no Black Studies in the absence of a relationship, a direct involvement in the community. Most of the programs that I see today, Africana studies, Black studies, whatever they're called, Afro-American studies, are simply another reflection of the very institution that we had pledged ourselves to destroy and reconstruct. And that much of the work of many of the people who benefited most from Black studies who are still in the academy, define themselves in terms of these academies, as opposed to defining themselves in terms of the work that they should be doing to foster the amelioration of the condition of our people and the development of our people, both in this country and around the world. That's the point I was trying to make.
And that is a critical point. That is a critical point because it has veered away from the birth, the thing that gave birth to it, which was to be in service to the community rather
Correct.
Than the individual faculty member, scholar, to be raised up as a great intellectual. But the great intellectual, are you following the model that Carter G. Woodson put out there as far as bringing about a change in the community by working with the community? I think that's the point that you're making.
Right.
And
that should be your way of life. See, the thing about it was that we were not preparing people. I just had a big struggle with some of my own students. Brother Kendi, who was a student of mine at Temple, and others. And I get very deep about this. These are people who are saying, well, Garrett, you're 80 years old and you're doing all this stuff around the world. What about your legacy? And my thing was that I can't define my legacy as being something different from my people. I don't have a legacy separate from my people. There's no Garvey legacy separate from the people that Garvey organized. There's no W.E.B. Du Bois legacy. I mean, you're supposed to have this thing about consolidating something that reaffirms themselves as opposed to using whatever skills and talents, whatever God-given capacity they have to absolutely dedicate that to the development of the people. That's not to say that people shouldn't earn a living. I don't really care how much money anybody's gotten. But if you take on the responsibility of, if you benefit from the struggles that other people have carried on, then it seems to me that some of your energy has to be given out to replicating that same energy, that same intellectual energy, physical energy, and wherever you see it, that becomes a normal part of your life. It's not something for you to be praised for, even though we all got egos and we want to be praised. My thing is that the praise for me is to sit down with a group of young people and have them their eyes pop open with wonder. That's praise. That's praise. That, to me, the benefit is to each generation, as Fanon said, must out of relative obscurity to discover its mission, fulfill it or betray it. And the people like myself, who is not long for this particular planet, person's job, if they have benefited from that struggle, is to provide any aid and comfort that you have that's available to regenerate and reify that process. That, to me, is the legacy of Black studies, Africana studies, not whether or not it goes all the way back or all the way up. Our history was usurped by Europeans. Our history was usurped by Europeans, and we have to take back that history and reconstruct that history from our own frame of reference. So the whole idea that I've heard somebody saying Black studies was primitive and Africana studies was advanced. Well, Garvey's point was that you're either at the basic level or the advanced level according to how all your people are. Question is, what is the circumstance of our people? It is our people and their circumstance that determines whether or not my stuff is foundational and your stuff is advanced. It is the people and the people's condition and how the people see themselves and the work that people do to reconstruct and reimagine themselves. That is the most important thing. And that's what Black Studies originally was about. And there are bits and pieces of it here and there. But there'll be something else that'll be bigger and stronger and deeper and more rich than Black Studies. I don't have any beef about that. I'm finished.
Very, very inspiring. Let's let's sit back for a minute and just think about what you just shared with us. Let's get a final PSA in there, and then we'll come back and sum up the program. Thank you so much, Dr. Jane Demi Garrett. Sister Cheryl, do we have a PSA up on deck?
Assalamu alaikum. This is Sabrita Hadi, Director of the MCNRD Model Community National Resource Directory, reminding volunteers of our upcoming MCNRD Social Connect Conference every last Sunday of the month, 1 o'clock p.m. to 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We look forward to your participation, so please check your email for conference call information. Thank you so kindly. Assalamu alaikum.
Peace be with you and welcome to Positive Solutions to Critical Issues, hosted by yours truly, Dr. Jamal Rashid and Instructor Henry Hasid. This program is sociologically as well as psychologically inclined, with Fitler as its base. We examine the root seed to multiple effects that impact our holistic daily lives. So tune in each and every Thursday morning from 7 to 8 Eastern Standard Time here on American Muslim 360. Thank you and have a pleasant day.
Okay. Brother James Garrett, Dr. James Garrett, we thank you for that. We want you to hold on. I want to bring in Brother Abdulrauf Nasir, who has worked for many, many years as a coordinator of the Islamic Studies Department at Masjid Warasin in Oakland. He conducts Arabic grammar classes, and annually he gives a Ramadan class for those who are, for all of us who are going into Ramadan, and then also for those who are going to make Hajj, he gives a Hajj class also. In 2015, he received the MS in Islamic Studies. Way back in the 80s, he spent some time, he and his family, over in Sudan for a Arabic intensive program. I dub him the resident historian of Masjid Warath Al-Din because he constantly documents the history of the Muslim community in the Bay Area, in the East Bay, in Oakland, in Richmond, and he has a wealth of knowledge, and he's been working on projects to preserve and to document that. Professionally, he has been a realtor throughout the years, and he retired as a chaplain from the California Department of Corrections a few years ago, although he is still very active with helping returning citizens from the department who have been formerly incarcerated people, helping them with their transition back into the broader community. Thank you for joining us, Brother Abdul Rauf Nasir. Many people refer to him as Sheikh. You hear somebody say Sheikh. You know, they're talking usually about Abdul Rauf Nasir here in our community. You were around during the development in the 60s, growing up in Berkeley and attending UC Berkeley also. I'm going to ask you this question because I know that you have engaged in your own personal genealogy project to look at the history of your family. Did the environment and what was going around in the 60s, early 70s, did that help to influence you to embark on your own personal genealogy study?
First of all, assalamu alaikum to the panelists and the organizers of this presentation.
Walaikum
assalam. Very appreciative of the efforts that have been made to put this together, and I feel a little bit out of I feel a little bit more like as someone said earlier, as a listener rather than a panelist. I think I'm better suited for that, and I've been inspired by Brother Omar and Dr. James Garrett in what they've presented to us. And actually, from the beginning of the program, my mind has been drawn to different spaces, from the announcements of the news, the earlier news, because in the news, of course, we that was one of the big focuses was on the balloon that was seen over on the East Coast, so supposedly a Chinese surveillance balloon.
Yes.
But it connected me with a situation that we were just close to, because that balloon was seen over North Carolina, and I think there was someone from North Carolina that was one of the questioners. If Brother Fleming, I think he mentioned being from North Carolina, something about North Carolina.
Yes.
So that me back to a couple of weeks ago, there was a presentation made at Stanford University by one of the leading Middle Eastern studies professors. He's emeritus from the University of North Carolina, along with another a professor from Duke University. You know, they're within, I think, 40 or 50 miles from each other. So they collaborated in a presentation they made about something that's connected in another kind of way with this month, Islamic, with this African-American Studies Month, Black History Month. And for us, of course, as Muslims, of course, we always try to make an Islamic connection as much as we can to that this celebration. And so they wrote a paper, or they're writing a book, actually. The book is not published yet, but the presentation that they made at Stanford was about the history of Omar Ibn Said. And Omar Ibn Said, many of you know, and others may have heard, he was a slave who was captured in the late 1700s, early 1800s. He had come from a family in the Senegalese area, Senegambia area, and but he came from a scholarly family, and so he was knowledgeable about Islam. He may have even been called an Islamic scholar. And so at 30 years old, he was captured, and he lived as a slave for the next 64 years until he was 94 years of age. What was unique about Omar Ibn Said is that he wrote a biography, as many slaves, ex-slaves did. Of course, we know Frederick Douglass and others wrote their biography. But he's, even though Frederick Douglass wasn't a Muslim, but I'm saying of the slaves that had been captured and became free and they wrote their biographies, autobiographies, the distinction of Omar Ibn Said is that he was the only slave that wrote his autobiography in Arabic. And so he lived long enough, and his memory was maintained strong enough for him to write his autobiography in Arabic. And so the presentation of these two professors was to speak about the autobiography of Omar Ibn Said. And their thesis, their theory was that his autobiography was not really an autobiography. The intent was to say and do something else, because he has been examined, his writings have been examined over the years by Orientalists, Islamic studies professors, Muslim scholars, et cetera, et cetera. And many of them focus on the fact that he converted to Christianity. And so these two professors, they challenged that thesis. Their book will be out in a couple of months. But I want to, you know, I've already deviated from what I really wanted to say. I know we don't have that much time left. But the beginning of this program reminded me of that connection to that event that we went to, and we may say something more about that at another time. Also, the presentations of Brother Omar and Dr. James Garrett has mentioned so many, even this references, the things that in my experience of rare in my personal experiences. Brother Omar, of course, from being from L.A., I went to, as Sister Matalai said, I went to, as an old man, almost 70 years old, I returned to college to do a master's degree in Islamic studies about 4 or 5 years ago at the institute, graduate institute in L.A. called the Bayan Graduate School of Islamic Studies. And I actually had to move down to L.A. in order to accomplish that. So I left my family for a couple of years, moved down there. And so I acted as a student, going back and forth during the holidays, so on and so forth. Of course, I'm married. I actually have 7 children. Most of them don't live in my home anymore, but I have 7 children. So this was a strange experience. And an odd experience in the eyes of some people, but I was able to do that and achieve that. After actually retired from working many, many years in the prison, as has been said, I worked as a volunteer actually in the early 1980s. Actually, in the late 1970s, I began working at San Quentin as a volunteer in the Islamic Studies program for Muslim prisoners who had just the first Muslim chaplain that was hired by the state of California was my mentor, one of my mentors, and my minister in the Nation of Islam, John Fakir, rest in peace. And he took me on as a volunteer in order to help the Muslim inmates there make the transition between what had been the Nation of Islam only 4 or 5 years, 3 or 4 years later, I'd say, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, rest in peace. He died in 1975, and he became, of course, his son became the leader. And as his son began to make important changes in the philosophy and the practice of the quote-unquote NOI, the Nation of Islam, we on the outside, of course, had to make those changes. And then, of course, in the prison system, the 90% of the prisoners in the California prison system, the CDCR, they call it, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, 95%, I would say, not based on a study, but based on going throughout the prisons, the 9 prisons or the 10 prisons that were existing at the time, 95% of the prisoners were members of the Nation of Islam. And there were maybe 5% of the prisoners who were in some other kind of Islamic persuasion, either 5 percenters and other Islamic groups that were there, Ansar al-Muhammad, and their variety of other names that they were associated with. But the point was, most of the prisoners were followers of the Nation of Islam philosophy. So they had to be updated on the changes that were being made in the on the outside through the leadership of Imam W.D. Muhammad. And so volunteers had to go in to help with that transition. And I started my work inside the prisons in that way. In the 19, Imam Fakir became the leader in 1978, and I started working with him. And for many years, I worked as a volunteer at not only San Quentin and other local prisons. And then eventually in 1996, I applied to be a chaplain in the prison. And so I became an employee of the state. And I worked in that job for perhaps until actually 2012 or 2013 when I retired in order to go back to school in order to increase my education in the field of Islamic studies. So this is off my topic.
So you are,
my topic
you, are you are a living example of the Raul. You are a living example of the Hadith. I'm paraphrasing here. Seek knowledge from the cradle to the grave. Right.
Yeah. I hope it's not too soon. like Dr. Garrett said, I hope we got more a few more days in front of us.
A few more days in
but
front of us.
We know in the end we will all experience the same end game, end fate, and we hope Allah gives us a few more days to make a few more to do a few more good deeds, inshallah.
Inshallah.
So
okay, so time is ticking. Let me ask you to make a few comments about your journey in researching your own family genealogy, number one.
Excellent.
And then number two, the obligation of us as Muslims and all good people in the society, really, to be civically engaged and working towards bringing about a change for the better in society. I know that's a lot, but if you could, in the next
take four minutes each. I'll try to say something about my work on my own family genealogy. Actually, genealogy is an Islamic tradition. Most of the time, when the Prophet, peace be upon him, he's identified in the short version is he's Muhammad ibn Abdullah, Muhammad the son of Abdullah, and he's connecting with his father. But the longer version is Muhammad ibn Abdullah, ibn Abdul Muttalib, ibn Hashim, either ibn. In fact, that version goes back many generations to Adnan, Adnan is a generational ancestor of Muhammad, and his branch of the Arab race or Arab genealogy is called Adnani. They call Adnani after that person who's maybe 30 generations before Muhammad. And then that generation goes back to Prophet Ibrahim, on him be peace, which is some say 40 more generations. So maybe 80 generations between Muhammad and his ancestor, Prophet Ibrahim. And, of course, we know Prophet Ibrahim's wife was the African lady, Hajar. And so that connects us with Prophet Muhammad's ancient ancestor, Hajar, who is credited with settling, being the founder, not the founder of Mecca, but the person who settled Mecca. Because in the Quran, of course, we know that it says that at the time when Ibrahim came there, it was a valley that didn't have any vegetation. So life there wasn't established. There were no buildings, there were no tents, there were no of that sort. So the Prophet brought his family there, and they settled there, and it was Hajar, the African lady, who settled that. So by that connection, some may say the Prophet Muhammad was an African, or he had definitely had the blood of Africa in his veins, and along with the others. And, of course, from Abraham, his genealogy goes back to Adam, the first man, that we all share that genealogy. So genealogy is something that's inspired by the religion, and I was not fortunate enough to get that inspiration to the degree that I researched my own genealogy until 2004. Actually, I had begun earlier than that, but at the time, before computers, everything was done manually. It was done. You had to go, and you had to. The technology was microfilm, and it was very, very difficult to make progress starting from where most of us had to start from, which is very little. Of course, we know that during slavery, one of these was to take our genealogy from us. We were robbed of our name, our culture, our religion, all those things. And among those things was who your fathers were and who their fathers were, because these are the things that help to inspire people to achieve. And one of the slave masters said, according to one of the stories that we were told, and it's been verified, Henry Berry, he was a congressperson, I believe, in Virginia. He said, "We have as far as possible closed every avenue by which light may enter the slave's mind. If we could establish the capacity to see, if we could extinguish the capacity to see the light, our work would be complete, and they would be on the level of the beasts of the fields, and we would be safe." Robbing us of our genealogy was part of that process. Because that was one of the ways in which light can enter the minds of the slaves. You connect with your history, your ancestors in the past, and a light goes, and you see a way out of your dark situation. So, unfortunately, most of us have not been inspired enough to do the genealogy, and it's a difficult and an ongoing struggle. Long story short, we got a couple of minutes. I was actually invited to a family reunion by family on my mother's side from Florida in 2004, and I had never been invited to a family reunion before with an invitation. And they sent me the invitation, and I began to ask them questions about who was going to be there. They began to tell me people on my mother's side, and I began to ask questions about people on my father's side, and they didn't know anything about the people on my father's side because my father died when I was like 6 years old. And I didn't know him very well, of course. I remembered him, but not enough to have a clear knowledge of his side of the family. And so I started my research in 2004 and have been working on it on and off over the years from that time. I think that's probably as much as I can say about it right now. There's some stories I could tell about it and some great discoveries, in my opinion, about the family, exciting discoveries, personal discoveries that have that it increased my awareness of who I am today, Abdul Rauf, and that's what genealogy does when you connect with certain aspects of your history, the good and the bad, because there are some. I mean, everything is not wonderful. In fact, one of my grandfathers, I found an article in which he was arrested for selling alcohol in like 1899 or something, 1890 or something. He was arrested for selling alcohol, and he was going to court. I didn't find out what happened in the court, but things of that nature were there, as well as complementary things that we found out over the years. So this being Africans, Black History Month, of course, should increase our desire to know about our history as a group of people. And as a group of people, when I say a group of people, African-American people racially, but also as human beings, which is a bigger identity, as we just said about Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. He had African in his bloodstream, but he also had the blood of Adam in him, which is our first ancestor, as the Quran says, that we're Bani Adam, we're the children of Adam. All of us are the children of Adam. So that effort to discover that and how that elevates us is a challenge that we all have to take on, and we're still working on it. I'm still working on it, and probably will be until our days get shorter. So
thank you, Abdul. I think we'll end right there on that point.
Mm-hmm.
It was really enlightening and excellent. I appreciate you telling us that.
My
sharing trouble. Your knowledge and experience with us. I'm going to ask Carol and Fleming if they have any questions or any summary, because we're coming up on almost a minute and a half left in the broadcast time. Start with you.
I have one quick
question. Brother Fleming, go ahead, quickly.
Thank you very much. Just one quick question for Dr. Gary there. I was in Ghana and Benin in the summer of 2000 with some doctoral students from Bolton State University, and to my dismay, they could not do a PhD study of the African slave trade in Ghana or Benin. They had to go to Germany or, you know, France or Britain to do a, you know, terminal degree. And I was just wondering, had that changed from your experience since the summer of 2000? Inshallah, I'm going back over to Ghana in August of this year for 4 weeks. But I wanted to know if you know of any other developments along that line in terms of doctoral
studies. I think that things have gotten a little bit better in the University of Ife in Nigeria and at Tanzania and Dar es Salaam, where there have been some expansion on the library. And there are a number of universities in Egypt and other places that, from the perspective of Islam, where there are some studies on that history. But I don't think the power relations in the world have not fundamentally changed. There's been some pulls and pushes, but not fundamentally. I'm going to Namibia in a minute, in a couple of months. So, and they're trying to do that, bring as much information from Germany that was stolen from the Herero people. They have to go and bring their history back. You have to go and capture it from the people who control it.
Yes,
I'm going to do a project in Namibia.
We are going to get... No problem. With that, it's so much good information. We never seem to have enough time. Time is rolling. But with that, we are going to bid everyone with the best of the salams, and we leave you with this. change what you see, change how you see it, and you see what changes. And we will see you all next Monday, same time, same channel. And we look forward to more enlightening discussion. Stay tuned. We have another program starting in a couple of hours. And we thank all of our panelists, our wonderful panelists, and our listeners. And take us out of here, Sister Matla. And I'm going to play one more announcement. Everybody, assalamu alaikum. This is Sister Matla.
Wa alaikum assalam. Just thank you to everyone for joining us, panelists. Dr. James Garrett, Brother Umar Hakeem Day, Brother Abdul Rauf Nasir, and our listening audience, tune back in next Monday, 10 o'clock Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and everybody else in the middle, you know your times. Thank you. May God's peace be with everyone. As-salam alaikum.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.